The next appeal before the court this morning is State of South Dakota versus Lee Malcolm. On behalf of the appellant, Scott Bratlin is present, will be arguing. On behalf of the appellee, State of South Dakota, Chelsea Wenzel is present and will be arguing, and Ginny Jorgensen is also present at council table. With that, Mr. Bratlin, you may proceed with your initial argument.
Council, my name is Scott Bratlin. I'm an attorney from Watertown. I represent Lee Malcolm in this appeal. Mr. Malcolm was convicted of 9 counts of raping his longtime girlfriend based on allegations that she was too intoxicated to consent. The basis for this appeal is that he did not receive a fair trial due to the abuse of discretion by the trial court and that his trial counsel was ineffective. I'm not going to go over all the facts of the case because they're in the brief and they're not really contested. What I did take issue with was what was viewed as evidence and what was not viewed as evidence. Procedurally, I would like to point out that Lee Malcolm first appeared in court in January of 2020, and this case wasn't tried until March of 2021. And in the months leading up to that trial, everybody involved knew this case was about advanced consent.
He actually was, I'm a plural, but he was actually in court on the earlier case that had been dismissed in October, November of the previous year.
That's correct. And for months, that was the issue. Everybody knew it. Lee Malcolm knew it. The prosecutor knew it. The defense attorney knew it. They had a motion hearing a few days before the jury trial. The prosecutor specifically said, while the state cannot limit evidence of consent on the date in question, we can ask that prior acts of the parties be limited or excluded. So at that point, they knew this was about advanced consent. Even in jury selection, the prosecutor said specifically, she asked the jury panel, what if she gave consent before she passed out? Is that good enough for you? One of the jurors says, I have to think on that one. I don't know. The prosecutor says, no, that's okay. That's a hard question. That's a hard question, but it's a question that you'll be instructed on this week. And that's my point on this first issue, is it should have went to a jury instruction. Defense counsel gave an opening statement, and he talked about advanced consent. He talked about pass-out sex. He promised to have these witnesses.
I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you. Why isn't this a legal issue for the court, and why does it matter whether or when counsel made these statements? If this is really a legal issue for the court, whether this is a recognizable defense?
Why he made those statements matters because he told the jury, going to show the jury. He told the jury this case was about pass-out sex and advanced consent, and he told them they would hear from 5 witnesses about that.
So does that really go to your ineffective assistance claim more so than?
It's difficult because when I raise these issues, they reply in their brief and say it's the attorney's fault, but it's not that big of a deal. That's what I'm up against here. But it does go to ineffective assistance, but I want to tell you what happened during the trial. 6 witnesses testified. This is after the opening statement given by a defense attorney, talked about pass-out sex. He talked about advanced consent. He talked about their unusual and crazy sex life, and there was no objection from the state. At no point was there an objection from the state. There was nothing done pre-trial to exclude this testimony.
But, of course, that's the argument. Excuse me, the statement or the argument, in this case, statement of counsel, wouldn't be evidence in and of itself, wouldn't obligate or preordain the admissibility of any evidence during the trial. Would you agree with that?
I agree with that.
Can I stop you once quick? I want to make sure that we get to your arguments, but I also want to get to some questions. Here's a couple thoughts. One, it seems like there's 2 categories of evidence. One, there's the category of evidence that is the prior instances of sexual conduct involving Malcolm and your client and JC. And by the way, to be clear, for everybody, you were not the trial counsel in this case. Somebody else was. And that's a part of your arguments as well.
That's correct.
So we've got that prior, those prior instances of conduct. Then we have some evidence about what was happening on or about this 27th and 28th of October time frame. So as to the prior instances of conduct between these two, do you agree that the provisions of Rule 412, which is commonly known as our rape shield statute, which generally prohibit this evidence, would you agree that that conduct implicates the provisions of Rule 412?
Yes, they should have had a 412 hearing.
On that, I read your brief to suggest that, of course. do you believe that the evidence was admissible under an exception to Rule 412? That I didn't see in the brief, and I want to get your argument on that.
I believe it's admissible under 412.
Under what theory?
This is the pattern and practice of these parties. If he would have testified, it makes it very difficult because we don't have much of a record here.
But you have to identify at some level a theory under the evidentiary rule that would permit admissibility.
This was a pattern and practice that they had. They consensually had this type of sex, unusual sex, involving threesomes and games, and this is what they did.
But that's
and
a theory.
And it was relevant.
And that's a theory, correct. And that's an argument that you have, but there are discrete exceptions within Rule 412. And unless you're within, and one of them is sort of a more of a broader one, but there's nevertheless discrete exceptions. Which one of this would apply, one and two? Is that in your brief?
That is not in my brief. I would say that you don't have much of a record here. For some reason, there was a hearing held a few days before the trial, and this gets the ineffective assistance and the court's involvement. At that hearing, Lee Malcolm was on the ITV screen, television that we have in Watertown. He's from the jail. He appears that way. There's a 412 hearing. The motion wasn't filed by the defense. It was filed by the state to keep this evidence out. The first thing you hear is Lee Malcolm saying, is my attorney going to be here? And the judge says, this is your attorney. And he says, I don't know that person. And the judge basically says, that's not my problem. And they have that hearing, but they can't have it because the defense attorney doesn't know what that hearing is. When the judge asks who your witnesses are for this hearing, he says, I don't have to tell you that. He's never done one of these hearings. The judge is correct in saying that in his brief, he didn't address this issue at all. So they couldn't have that hearing. Lee Malcolm is on the screen trying to argue this 412 motion. The judge then asks if he knows what an offer of proof is again. He says, yes. She doesn't believe that. She said, this hearing is over. I expect people that appear in front of me to know the facts and know the law. And so they never were able to have that 412 hearing. And most importantly, Lee Malcolm didn't testify at that hearing.
Well, didn't the court invite them to follow that up with a separate motion question further hearing when regular counsel was present?
Absolutely.
And they didn't?
No. There's no indication that the attorney that showed up at the 412 hearing had ever met Lee Malcolm.
I don't know that Mr. Malcolm testified so much as he argued. I don't know that it was sworn testimony.
Excuse me?
Mr. Malcolm he didn't testify so much as he argued and made an argument at the end of the hearing.
Exactly. Somebody had to do something for him because his attorneys weren't doing anything. He apologized and he tried to argue the 412 motion. But my point is that during the trial, Nobody made any objections at all to this advanced consent. The state had called six witnesses. At that point, they had a issue with some testimony, and the judge, for the first time, said, this trial seems like it may be about advanced consent. I'm going to have to do some research on that. And that's what happened. The state proceeded with the additional witnesses. When the state rested, the defense made motions for judgment of acquittal on the nine counts. They talked about jury instructions a little bit. And again, the judge brings it up and says, I've done some more research on that. You're not calling those witnesses to testify. You can do so by an offer of proof. And at that point, the defense attorney is stuck because he's told the jury what his defense would be, pass out sex, advance consent. The judge in this case allowed the offer of proof. Those people testified about unusual sexual activity between the parties, their pattern and practice of pass out sex, advance consent sex. And the judge said, I'm not allowing that testimony. There's no controlling authority, but I would rely on People versus Dancy. And my point is, in every single case that I cited, every single case that they cited, a judge never did this. This was an argument over a jury instruction. When she read from People versus Dancy, and you read the facts in Dancy, the victim talked about, this is what we did. I would be sleeping and wake up to him having intercourse with me. He testified to the same thing. Dancy was a jury instruction. She was reading from a jury instruction.
But, of course, in this case, the victim has passed away, and never essentially regained consciousness on the 28th of October. So
that's correct.
There's no testimony. There's not going to be any testimony. And the theory of rape that's contemplated here is the theory that contemplates, you know, this incapability or this incapacity to give consent.
That's correct.
So why is that a meaningful difference between this case and that case on the legal issue? Whether someone whether someone testified or didn't testify, the jury's instructions and the judge develops the instructions based upon the law, maybe not so much, based upon the law.
Well, counsel is ineffective for not asking those questions of Lee Malcolm at the 412 hearing that was held on Wednesday before the trial. He was also ineffective when she did give him the opportunity to say, you can have your witnesses testify at this offer of proof. Lee Malcolm wasn't called to testify, and he's the only one that really needed to testify because we have an incomplete record about their sexual activity. We have four or five people saying, I knew they did some different things, but Lee Malcolm needed to testify and tell everything that they did over the last 10 years that they've been going out and living together for 5 years. He was never called, so there's an incomplete record in that respect. But what I'm saying is, in every single case that I cited, every single case they cited, the defendant got to talk about what happened. The defendant got to say everything about what happened. He couldn't talk about what led up to this, about their pattern and practice. He couldn't talk about what happened.
But if the court's legal determination ultimately is the theory of advanced consent is not a valid defense, why would that be an abuse of discretion? Which is to say, circling back to Justice Devaney's question originally, aren't we talking about a legal determination concerning the efficacy of the advanced consent theory?
I believe that's true, but I've never seen a case in all my years and all my research where this is how it happened.
But if she's right, if the court's right, then the evidence shouldn't come in. So shouldn't we focus on the legal validity of consent theory?
You should, but you didn't have enough in the record to make that determination because Lee Malcolm never testified about the facts and circumstances. He wasn't allowed to testify about anything.
Counsel, maybe we can move beyond that point. Let's assume that he was allowed to make an offer of proof about what he claims happened that night. Why, in your view, is that a legal defense to the charge at issue here?
This is what they did. I can't find a controlling case in South Dakota. There's not much law on this. You don't find opinions when you research about defendants who won their case. You can just find discussions about advanced consent. And in this case, like the other cases I cited, advanced consent was mentioned. One judge even went on to say that there was no testimony about advanced consent. And so I believe that is a legal defense for him. He just didn't get a chance to talk about that.
And what about the idea that if someone were to give advanced consent, and we indulge this idea for purposes of the discussion that it could exist, if the person subsequently loses capacity to consent, and as I read your brief, by the way, that doesn't seem to be in dispute. Am I wrong on that? You would agree that JC, at the time the sexual penetration acts took place, did not have the capacity contemporaneously to consent? Are you in agreement with that?
Yes.
So let's say that situation occurs. With advanced consent and subsequent incapacity during the acts of sexual penetration, the person, the victim, alleged victim, however you'd like to say it, would have no ability to withdraw consent. Does that seem to be an issue or a problem? In other words, it would irrevocably, regardless of what happened during the period of their incapacity, it would irrevocably lock that person into consent.
Every one of these cases is different. Every case I cited talks about two people that are intoxicated, and you're trying to figure out the levels of intoxication. I believe that she was intoxicated, obviously. I think he was intoxicated. I think he would agree to that. But in all the cases I cited, the defendant got to talk about exactly what happened and what led up to that. He didn't get to talk about that. And I think that's a violation of his due process rights. He didn't get a fair trial.
Isn't the point of our law that it's when a person is intoxicated, they're incapable of consenting at that moment?
There has to be an instruction on intoxication, I believe. Like I said in my brief, there was nothing on that.
Well, is that really in dispute here?
I don't know that it's in dispute, but I think there had to be some direction on that. I would say with respect to the ineffective assistance of counsel, I've talked about that a little bit. I know I have to show exceptional circumstances here, and I think I can very easily. I've never seen less done for a client than was done for Lee Malcolm here. When you read the transcripts and you read my brief about that hearing, I was embarrassed to read the brief. I was more embarrassed to go through the Odyssey system and not find one pretrial motion filed by the defense in 14 months. I didn't even try to defend Lee Malcolm. I understand the court made it more difficult by basically turning this into a court trial instead of a jury trial, made it more difficult for him because he told the jury all these things that were going to happen. We're going to hear testimony about advanced consent and pass-out sex. And when the judge decided on her own accord...
You need to wrap up, Mr. Brantley.
Yes. When the judge decided on her own accord, that was an abuse of discretion. Thank you.
Thank you. Wenzel, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. A defendant has a right to present a defense, but that defense must be supported by law and have foundation in the evidence. As counsel said, the relevant facts in this case are largely undisputed. After an evening of heavy drinking, the defendant and his girlfriend, JC, returned home around 2 a.m. and went to bed. JC woke up around 5 a.m. The defendant described her as out of it and very drunk and figured her muscle relaxers were kicking in. The defendant claimed that JC told him that she could have, or that he could have sex with her, even if she passed out, and that she asked him to tape it. According to the defendant, this was their common practice. So the defendant went down, took a shower, and sometime later from 8 to 10 a.m. in the morning, he did penetrate JC in a number of different ways while she was passed out.
I hate to interrupt. He says that's their practice in argument. If you examine the trial transcripts, I know you have, in the pretrial proceedings, he doesn't actually say that ever in an offer of proof that I could see. So that's a theory. It appears in an argument, appears in some briefs. But when it comes right down to what he says under oath, I didn't see it. Have I missed it?
I'm not aware of any under oath testimony. Yes, that was the theory that they had done or had engaged in pass-out sex. There was obviously some testimony or in an offer of proof from other witnesses that was excluded improperly. So, but
his mother mentioned it briefly during her offer of proof. That I did see.
Yes. Yes. And we do have the videos. We see that she was snoring. She was unable to move. Defense counsel agreed that at the time she was not capable of giving consent, and she did later die of an overdose, having taken all 30 of her muscle relaxers. At trial, the defense really was that it was okay, right? And that is the whole point of this case, that it was okay for him to do this because he thought that she was able to consent prior to. But the trial court correctly determined that defense is not supported by South Dakota law, nor was it supported by the facts of the case. Under subsection 4 of 22221, the state has to prove the defendant accomplished an act of sexual penetration that wasn't disputed, that the victim was incapable of giving consent because of intoxication, again, not disputed. And the defendant knew or should have known that she was incapable of giving consent. And that's important. That is the mens rea or the intent required. So to the extent defendant would argue that he has a right to a consent defense, I think you brought it up, Justice Salter, the act criminalized is having sexual intercourse or sexual penetration with someone who defendant knows is incapable of giving consent. That is the act in question. That is the prohibited act. Even if a victim would verbally consent that day or hours before, that cannot be the basis for a valid consent defense unless at the time of and during penetration, the victim was capable of consenting or withdrawing consent.
So there's a temporal component to the ability to consent.
Yes.
And do you source that argument to a common law concept or something that's developed in the case law, not so much here because we don't have these cases, but elsewhere? Or do you source that to the statutory text, or both, or where do you get there?
I would point both to the statutory text and just the legal principle that defendant's state of mind and his intent is relevant at the time of the act. And again, the act prohibited isn't having or sexual penetration with a victim who didn't ever consent.
Talking more about the ability more so than his intent. So there's, I wonder, and I see the arguments as being that there is a temporal component to the victim's ability to consent. And so this idea of advanced consent is you know, not valid as a matter of law. Do you think that's a textual matter from 2222.1 or something we need to graft onto the statute and pull a common law source in from somewhere else to do that?
And if I'm understanding your question, I think the temporal component is in the statute, right? Because what is prohibited? Having sexual intercourse with someone who is incapable of giving consent. And it's at the time of the act, right? That is the act. So it's not whether she was capable of consent 5 hours prior or 6 hours after, at the time. So I think that's where the temporal, I guess, temporal component comes from. And in People v. Dancy, I thought they did, that court did a very nice job of explaining why it matters at the time. And I mean, in every other, type of rape, even forcible rape, just because the victim says yes at a different point in time, they are capable or they are able to withdraw. And if they're not able to withdraw that consent because of force or coercion or something like that, again, then that is rape. And here, the defense that Malcolm was trying to push forward, that he thought it was reasonable or that, she was able to consent before, he didn't present any facts showing that she was capable of consent at the time of the act. Again, his defense was pass out sex, right? So he had no intention of offering these facts. So what she did before, was not relevant to at the time of the act or her capability at the time of the act. And really what his defense comes down to is that he didn't know that her advanced consent wasn't legally valid. Well, that's a mistake of law. And it's very well settled. It's codified in 22.3.1, subsection 3 of our statutes. A mistake of law is not a defense. The state was not required to know or show that he knew that what he was doing was illegal. We only had to show that he knew that she was incapable of giving consent at the time. To the extent defendant says he's just entitled to tell his story, that's not what the law says. Yes, a defendant has a right to present a defense, but he also must follow the rules of evidence and the rules of procedure that that our legislature passed and that this court enforces.
In that regard, what do you make of the 412 issue in this case? Is it a 412 issue in terms of admissibility, or is it an argument about noncompliance with the separate motion and notice requirements of 412 and no more?
With regard to any instance of prior sexual intercourse that would have been tried to or was attempted to be brought in, first of all, under 412, no, it was not relevant. And, you'd ask defense counsel that question. It's not relevant. It was not relevant to any material fact, and our statute even says it needs to be relevant to consent. So it was not relevant under 412, but it also pass out sex, and I think this is kind of the concept of 412, too, that because it's not relevant, it shouldn't be. So it shouldn't be offered in trial, and that is what the trial court here explains, that this concept of pass out sex and allowing defendant to talk about pass out sex when that's not a legally valid valid type of consent could confuse the jury about the intent required.
Go ahead, please.
Wouldn't it have been best to make these determinations through a series of pretrial hearings to determine the validity of this advanced consent theory?
It's hard to say what would have been best. Certainly from the state's perspective, that would have been nice. But as far as from defendant's perspective, whether there was any kind of strategy behind why defense counsel didn't bring it up, on this record, we couldn't say. There certainly could be a reason to. Again, from my perspective and from the state's perspective, yes, that would be helpful, but I think that there could be reasons why you wouldn't want to bring it up until you had to.
And the statute itself, does it put the onus on the proponent of the evidence to bring it to the court's attention?
Yes, because there is the requirement that it has to be brought before. And I think the trial court did say that in this case, because there was no notice, that these acts couldn't come in. But they also didn't just rely on that notice. They also relied on the other things. And I think that's common of anyone who wants to bring forth evidence, right? The proponent has to bring forth the evidence. And obviously 412 is a little different in that you have to bring it, or you're required to bring it forward, I guess, sooner.
But the 412 issue seems interior to the advanced consent issue, right? Because the 412 issue contemplates prior acts of sexual conduct, not prior consent necessarily in on the 28th of October, but prior instances in the course of conduct, as Mr. Brown said. So that's what that's offered for. But it doesn't, it only matters, even in a best case scenario, if the advanced consent theory is valid. Would you agree with that?
Yes, conceivably it would only be relevant in this case if the advance consent a defense was legally valid. And it wasn't. And as we said, you know, the 412 issue is within kind of this bigger issue. But even the evidence that defendant allegedly was trying to get in through his testimony about pass-out sex, because the court also ruled on a larger scale, this concept of pass-out sex or advanced consent is not a legally valid defense. So whether it was prior instances or whether it was him talking about her advanced consent on the day of the sexual acts, that is what is not allowed in either scenario. And that is because of 403, because that would allow the jury, or the jury, it could confuse the jury, excuse me, about the intent required. Again, defendant's intent, or whether he thought it was reasonable for her to have consented hours before, does not, or is not relevant to the issues at trial, and that isn't the mens rea that's required. Also, it would allow the defendant to persuade the jury to absolve him of criminal responsibility because of a mistake of law. And this is the perfect example of persuading the jury in an illegitimate way, right? That's what 403 is meant to keep out. And I know defense counsel talked about how there was no offer of proof with regard to defendant's testimony. Again, on this record, we don't know why there was no offer of proof. It's possible that there was no good facts to offer. And if there's no good facts to offer, you probably would be a better idea not to bring forth an offer of proof. But on this record, we don't know.
Well, that was my original question about what Mr. Malcolm had said. But as we discussed, I mean, his mother said she overheard something along these lines. So there seems like there's at least that in the record. Would you agree?
Yes. Yes. I think his sister as well talked at least a little bit about something that could be conceived as pass-out sex. So if the court would like, I can talk about the jury instruction. I know defense counsel didn't have an opportunity to, but as far as the jury instructions are concerned, as we said in our brief, this was not preserved. He does not have a right, or I guess, this issue was not preserved. There was no jury instruction that was offered. So if this court were to review it, we would ask that you review it for plain error. That's what would be applicable in this scenario. I would also direct the court to, as far as like the missing element or the alleged missing element, to instructions 9 and 10. Between instructions 9 and 10, all of the statutory elements are included. And as this court has said, they read instructions as a whole. Also, there's no dispute that JC was incapable of giving consent. So there would be no prejudice, even if this court were to find that the jury instructions were not sufficient. And just to touch briefly, too, on the ineffective assistance of counsel. Counsel's obviously asked this court to review this on direct appeal. This court has said time and time again, these are not ineffective assistance of counsel claims are not appropriate for direct review.
That's usually, though, so that the record can be developed in the habeas on prong one of Strickland, so that, as you said earlier, the court can hear evidence about why a defense lawyer may have done something or not done something, so that the court can understand tactical calls and strategy and all of that. Of course, there's prong two of Strickland as well, and that's the outcome determinative prong. Even if counsel's performance fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, did it matter? And that's prong two. Could we reach prong two on direct appeal? If the only question relates to the question of advance consent?
I mean, I don't think that this, again, without the record, I don't think it's, I guess, whether this court can do something, obviously you guys, or obviously this court may review something. I think here, yes, I'll say this. Counsel did what he could with the facts of this case. So as it goes to prejudice, I think that would be, if this court were inclined to review an ineffective, or this ineffective assistance of counsel claim on direct appeal, that there would be no prejudice shown. Again, I don't think that this is the appropriate way, because we don't have that record, and in line with this court's prior precedent. I think it's also very interesting what the trial court said. The trial court, in addressing defendant's concerns, said she did not observe any ineffectiveness, and she even addressed some of the concerns that he brought forth at trial. You know, she noted defendant was likely frustrated by the fact that the evidence in this case was overwhelming, and that is the prejudice standard. Would there have been something different? Would there have been a different result? Here, the answer is no. The evidence was overwhelming. Defendant taped himself doing what he did, which is illegal under the statute. And there's no indication that that evidence got in improperly or was...
You need to wrap up, Ms. Winslow.
Oh, I'm sorry. The state just respectfully asks for this court to affirm the trial court's rulings and defendant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bratlin, you may proceed with rebuttal argument.
First of all, Justice Salter, when you ask questions about 412, you have to understand that there's nothing in 412 that talks about advance consent. And so we can't really say 412 would have been held and useful to the defense unless advance consent is a defense, because there's nothing in 412 that talks about admissibility for the purpose of advance consent. It talks about consent. And that would be an issue for us. I would like to talk about what Justice Kern said. This should have been dealt with pre-trial by both parties. There's no doubt this should have never gone this far. If you have a case like this, as a defense attorney, when you get the pretrial order, you can propose jury instructions, and that's what had to happen here. And that didn't happen here. If that would have happened here, I wouldn't be here today, because the judge would have ruled one way or the other, and I think we know how she would have ruled on that issue, but then you don't have a jury trial. You have the right to propose instructions and present evidence on that issue. And that's what should have been done here, so he wouldn't have looked so foolish in front of the jury when he promised all this testimony about pass-out sex and advanced consent sex. When the judge decided, I think incorrectly, at that procedure and time when she did it, but that's what she said, he ended up arguing that the police botched the investigation. And so the jury had to be wondering what was going on, because he told them all these things, and all these law students know that. In your opening statement, you give a preview of what you're going to show in your case. And I'm going to show you five witnesses, and they're going to tell you all this crazy sex life, this unusual sex life. And then Lee Malcolm finds out, before these witnesses are going to testify, that he has no defense. He literally has no defense based on that ruling, and it should have never got to that point. And when you're talking about ineffective assistance of counsel, he couldn't have done less. When you look at Chronic, I would ask the court to consider this under Chronic. Interestingly enough, when I researched Chronic and Strickland, they were decided the very same day. And they were done that way for a purpose. They stand for something different. When you look at what was done in Chronic, you can consider ineffective assistance on direct appeal under Chronic.
But you still have to prevail under prong two. right? You still have to show that it was outcome determinative and that it mattered. So you would have to win the legal issue before we would reach ineffective assistance.
No. You show under Chronic, they talked about the Chronic case, interesting case. The defendant was charged with writing bad checks. The court appointed an attorney to represent him who was a real estate attorney. And the Court of Appeals thought that was horrendous, that a real estate attorney who had never done a criminal case would be his attorney. And they thought that was ineffective right there. The United States Supreme Court said, no, look at the performance of the attorney. And there's a reason it's different than Strickland. They decided it the same day. And Chronic said, first thing you should look at is, was counsel denied at a critical stage in the proceedings? He was denied counsel at the 412 hearing. We can argue about the merits of 412, but the fact that he never had the hearing because he'd never met this attorney that showed up, Lee Malcolm's on the screen saying, who is this person? I don't know who this is. I've never spoken to him. And so he certainly wasn't going to have Lee Malcolm testify because they'd never met, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, it wasn't. Arguably, it wasn't a 412 hearing because the state brought it as a motion. In limine, there had been no notice, no separate motion,
right,
as the procedure requires.
To the extent that you can call that offer of proof during trial, a 412 hearing, he should have been called at that hearing. There's no excuse not to call him at that hearing. It didn't make any sense. The second area Chronic said to look at is if counsel failed to subject the prosecutor's case to meaningful and adversarial testing. Absolutely. When Lee Malcolm was there facing 225 years in prison, and he knew for 14 months he had this defense, and then he found out right before he was going to testify that he had no defense, that's not his fault. That's his attorney's fault. When you look at, there's just nothing the attorney did that for him at all.
But what about the situation, and I'm not saying this is, you know, we're considering this appeal now, but what about the possibility that he, in fact, does not have that defense? And no amount of advocacy from the most skilled and experienced attorney is going to change that legal reality.
I don't think that excuses that conduct. Can you imagine Lee Malcolm sitting in this trial, and two law enforcement officers in a row get up and testify that they've known Lee Malcolm forever, and you don't object to that testimony? You're just not even trying? You don't make a motion for a mistrial, because I guarantee you a motion for mistrial would have been granted. When Chad Stahl gets up there and says, I took a crack at this interrogation because I've known Lee Malcolm for a long time, I don't care if you don't have a defense. You have to defend your client to the best of your abilities. And he didn't do anything for him. He confused the jury. And getting back to what Justice Kern said, this probably shouldn't have went to trial. This should have been something handled pre-trial. Discussion should have been had. There should have been a hearing on this. But you could not have done less for your client than he did here. It's embarrassing. When you read that transcript, it's embarrassing.
Mr. Bratlin.
Yes. You have a room full of law students here. They're wondering what's expected of them if they're court-appointed to represent somebody. You can look the other way and say all you have to do is show up for the trial, or you can tell them we expect something more. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.